Good morning. Ramadan Mubarak for all of our Muslim sisters and brothers who today start a month of fasting and prayer. Pride Week starts very soon in Victoria, and I've been asked to give a little history lesson. I've also been told because there's no children's program, I can take an hour. It's a history lesson, but there is no test at the end, except for the test that is written on your hearts. Gays and lesbians were widely feared and openly persecuted in North America until recent times. Today I want to tell you how a riot outside a gay bar and an international medical crisis led Canadians of all affections to openly celebrate their GLBT neighbors in pride parades. I want to connect these stories with your stories. And in the end, I want to exhort you to join in the Pride Parade next Sunday, either marching or cheering from the sidelines. Because I have been a Unitarian for 20 years, I know that some of my audience will want to pick away at some of the words I use in this homily. I beg your indulgence if I use the initials GLBT in the wrong order for you, or if I miss the initial that stands for you or your loved one. If I don't address your particular issue or hurt, and there are issues and hurts around us, I invite you to send an email to Pat Kinraid telling in your email you can tell Pat when you are available to speak from this pulpit and right all of my wrongs. When I was a kid growing up in a mid-sized town in the BC interior, I was one of those kids whose quiver of taunts included the words fag, fairy, and homo. I knew that I was straight. If I gave any thought to homosexuality at all, it was only in passing. I can remember that in grade 6, I learned that Elton John's writing partner, Bernie Taupin, had quit because Elton was gay. And I didn't question Bernie's decision. It just made sense. That's what you would do if you found out your work colleague was gay. It was not until I was 28 that I learned that one of my close friends was gay. He was teaching little kids at a Roman Catholic school in a northern village, so he was deeply closeted. When he told me that he was gay, my only thought was, how could I not know? We remained friends until I moved to another city, and I sadly lost contact with him. In 1992, I, an unchurched humanist, was working along a New Testament fundamentalist. But I'm getting ahead of myself, so here's a little history for your Sunday morning. 2,400 years ago, Socrates was a teacher in Athens. His student Plato wrote books that contained the ideas and the teachings of Socrates. One of those books is called Symposium, a word that means drinking party. People didn't know that. Next time you go to a symposium, that's why there are glasses there. At this drinking party, Socrates and his intellectual friends argued that love between males was the highest form of love, while sex with women is lustful and utilitarian. Wise Socrates differed. Socrates argued that there is a love that is higher than the love of smooth-faced boys and women, the love of beauty and wisdom. He doesn't tell his friends to give up their sexual affairs with men. Socrates simply says that physical love is not the highest kind. Because Plato wrote Symposium, so Socrates talking, but Plato wrote Symposium, we call this non-physical love Platonic in his honor. I tell this story because for many years it was not taught in an accurate translation in English. For decades, Symposium was taught in English without the naughty bits about men having sex with men. Only once a student had learned to read Greek could he discover what the fuss was about. That among the elites of Athens, birthplace of so much of our culture, men openly loved men and women, and women openly loved women and men. But it didn't stay that way forever, did it? So what is all the fuss about? What's the fuss about with pride? Why do Unitarian Universalists single out lesbian, gay, bisexual, and or transgendered persons as a focus for concern? Unitarian Universalist minister Douglas Morgan Strong states it well in the Welcoming Congregation booklet. He writes, "For centuries, churches have been a leading force against sexual minorities. It is not surprising that gay people are reluctant to reach out to the very institution that oppresses them. Yet gay, lesbian, transgender, and bisexual people have no less need for warmth, caring, and affirmation than anyone else, especially anyone else who calls the liberal church their home. In fact, as a subculture in society, gay, lesbian, transgendered, and bisexual people may need our support more than the general population." The first ordained minister of any religious sect in the United States or Canada to come out was a Unitarian minister in 1969. There have been Unitarian resolutions supporting people regardless of sexual orientation since 1970. In Boston, the Unitarian Universalist Association, and we're still connected with them, maintains an office called Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and Queer Ministries. They established in 1973 the Office of Gay Affairs, and the Unitarians were the first religion to have a dedicated office for that. The UUA has officially supported Unitarian Universalist clergy performing services of union for same-sex couples since 1984, and same-sex marriages in the United States since 1996. A little bit more history, because I have an hour. In 1957 in Great Britain, there was a departmental committee on homosexual offences and prostitution. It was named after the Lord who was in charge of it, Wolfenden, Lord Wolfenden. He and his small committee took depositions from people in prostitution, but also in prisons for being gay, and they spoke to religious leaders. And in the end, they disregarded the conventional ideas of the day, and they recommended that homosexual behavior between consenting adults in private should no longer be a criminal offense. 10 years later in Canada, as Minister of Justice, Pierre Trudeau was responsible for introducing the landmark Criminal Law Amendment Act, an omnibus bill whose provisions included, among other things, the legalization of contraception, abortion, lotteries, I think those are connected, and the decriminalization of homosexual acts between consenting adults. He echoed Great Britain's Wolfenden report when Trudeau famously defended the decriminalization of homosexual acts by telling reporters, many of you know the term, there's no place for the state in the bedrooms of the nation. So I've just talked a little bit about the deep background. Now I want to talk about Stonewall. Put up your hand if you've heard of the Stonewall riot. Oh, good. For some of you, this will be news. It was news to me about 10 years ago. The Stonewall riots were a series of spontaneous, violent demonstrations by members of the gay community against the police raid that took place in the early morning hours of June 28, 1969, at the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village in New York City. These riots are widely considered to constitute the single most important event leading to the gay liberation movement and the modern fight for gay and lesbian rights in the United States. Because our societies are so closely linked, gay liberation in the States helped similar efforts in Canada. The social repression of the 1950s resulted in a cultural revolution in Greenwich Village. Poets and troubadours wrote about the evils of social organization at the time, and they glorified anarchy, drugs, and the hedonistic pleasures over unquestioning social compliance, consumerism, and closed-mindedness. I think we could have some of this sort of talk today. Of them, Allen Ginsberg and William S. Burroughs, both lived in Greenwich Village, wrote bluntly, enthusiastically, and honestly about homosexuality. And their writings attracted more gay people to Greenwich Village. New York City was going to host the World's Fair in 1964, and the mayor decided that the gay bars were a blight on New York City, as though that was the only problem. So he authorized the police to clean out all the gay bars. The police had been doing this on a sort of ad hoc basis all the time. But one of the problems for the police was that the mafia owned the few gay bars that there were, including the Stonewall Inn. And as long as everybody got paid the appropriate amount, then the bars were allowed to operate. Every now and then the police would still go in, arrest a few people, take them out, and everybody was happy. The American legal system at the time, and I'm sure the Canadian legal system at the time, was distinctly anti-homosexual. But in the late 1960s, with the African American Liberation Organization or movement, the counterculture, anti-war demonstrations, New York City was set for riots of all different kinds. Few establishments in the 1950s and 60s would accept gays or lesbians. And the Stonewall Inn, owned by the mafia like the rest of them, catered to an assortment of patrons and was known to be popular among the poorest and most marginalized people in the gay community. Drag queens, members of a newly self-aware transgender community, effeminate young men, male prostitutes, and homeless youth. The police raid on the night of June 28th was going to be a routine police raid, but it got out of hand because the drag queens decided they'd had enough of being locked up, and they stood up to the police. And very shortly thereafter, people from all the bars in the neighborhood came out and stood up to the police. And at one point, the police found themselves trapped inside the Stonewall Inn, and all the drag queens and gays and lesbians were on the outside, chanting and cheering. New York City police sent the SWAT team in and negotiated for the release of the police who had been locked inside. The next night, so now we're talking about June 28th proper, the next day, gays and lesbians, but mostly gay men and drag queens, marched in the streets and took the streets of Greenwich Village. The next year, June 28th, 1970, the first gay pride marches took place in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Chicago, commemorating the one-year anniversary of the Stonewall riot. They covered the 51 blocks from Greenwich Village to Central Park, and they had a plan for how long it was going to take. But there was so much excitement and fear that it only took half as much time to cover those 51 blocks. The marchers encountered little resistance from onlookers. The New York Times reported that the marchers took up the entire street for 15 city blocks in 1970. And we continue to have marches on around June 28th, yesterday. The growth of lesbian feminism in the 1970s at times conflicted with gay liberation, and some lesbians refused to work with gay men. There's more about this story later. Many lesbians found men's attitudes patriarchal and chauvinistic because they were, after all, men, and saw the same misguided notions that women saw in heterosexual men. The most important issues to gay men were entrapment and public solicitation, and these were not the issues of lesbians. So in 1977, a lesbian pride rally was organized as an alternative. I'm not sure how far that got, but eventually, as we'll see in my story, they joined together. Today, gay pride events are held annually throughout the world toward the end of June to mark the Stonewall riots. In 1994, New York City celebrated Stonewall 25 with a march that attracted 1.1 million viewers. So now you know about the Stonewall riot of 1969 and why Victoria and dozens of cities hold pride parades on or around June 28th. The next big landmark in my GLBT history lesson is the introduction of a new and deadly disease to our continent. Many of you have heard of, I would suspect all of you have heard of AIDS and HIV. The infection, the human immunodeficiency virus infection, which led to AIDS, acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, had been killing people in Africa since the 1960s and had been brought gradually into North America through marginalized populations. But it was in 1981 in San Francisco that suddenly 280 men, many of whom were heroin addicts. This confused a lot of the issue, but many of them were gay men. 240 or 280 suddenly became sick with more or less the same complications, a sarcoma and eventually pneumonia. So the Center for Disease Control started to work on that, and they gave it all kinds of different names because it was so hard to pin down. But it was seen as, it was the 4-H disease. And I thought that was interesting because I can barely remember that, but I remember that. It was called 4-H disease because it affected Haitians, homosexuals, hemophiliacs, and heroin users. One of the high-profile cases, who remembers who was the actor who surprised everybody by getting AIDS? Rock Hudson, who was the most macho, gorgeous, romantic leading man, turned out to have been a gay man all his life, and died in 1985. He had announced only months before, that he was suffering from HIV. In the UK, Nicholas Eden, the son of a former prime minister, also died of AIDS. And 1991, of course, the lead singer of Queen, Freddie Mercury, passed away also from AIDS. But Arthur Ashe was a tennis player and straight. But he had had surgery that required a blood transfusion, and he contracted AIDS. And that increased the stigma of around blood transfusions and blood and AIDS. One effect of HIV and AIDS is that it rallied the gay community in a worldwide fight for a cure. The deaths of so many gay men gave gay villages the feeling of war zones. Condoms were known to prevent transmission of the disease, but not enough men took advantage of the protection. Bisexual men spread HIV to their female lovers, one effect of which was to ostracize gay men from some of their strongest allies. Some lesbian groups distanced themselves from the wider GLBT movement because they saw that HIV/AIDS was not their main issue as it was for gay men. Many churches refused to conduct funerals for men who had died of AIDS, but Unitarians, Quakers, and downtown Christians worked to fill the gap by providing compassionate celebrations of life. For many gay men in Canada and the United States, these actions cemented an enduring bond between the gay community and the Unitarians. I can only imagine what a pride parade would have been like in a neighborhood where the disease was snuffing out the life of the community. Marchers might have sung simply to hold back the tears. For men of a certain age, marching in next week's Victoria Pride Parade is a commemoration of lives lost. HIV/AIDS rallied the parents and families of the dying. When hospitals and social service agencies refused to treat gay men, it was often their parents who fought for equal rights for gays. In Toronto and in New York, there were groups, one was called POG, Parents of Gays. Another, of course, was Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays, which now calls itself PFLAG. They've left out what all the words mean, sort of like the USC. USC is no longer Unitarian Service Committee, it's just USC Canada. But PFLAG started in the 1970s and then grew in the 2000s of parents and friends supporting their lesbian and gay children. I sent an email to Terry Froud, who's at the Victoria Pride Society, and I said, "Who started the Victoria Pride Parade?" And Terry replied that he did, but as a picnic in Beacon Hill Park 22 years ago. There weren't enough people who were out to have a parade until about 3 years later. The Pride Society burbled along and then went broke, and then something happened 20 years ago, and I look forward to hearing more about what happened there. And then the parade started, and now, as many of us have seen, it's a family parade. In July of 2005, Canada became the fourth country in the world and the first country outside Europe to legalize same-sex marriage nationwide with the enactment of the Civil Marriage Act. During the hearings for that, there were Unitarian ministers, including my minister at Kingston, the Reverend Kathy Sage, who spoke clearly and convincingly to Parliament and the Senate about the importance of same-sex marriage. So now I've talked to you a little bit about Stonewall, a little bit about the global disease, and now I want to talk a little bit more about me. Earlier this morning I said that in 1992 I, an unchurched humanist, was working alongside a New Testament fundamentalist. The all-powerful head of our corporation stated that to bring our organization into line with Canada's Bill of Rights, we were all to accept gays and lesbians in our ranks. My work colleague was flummoxed. Sensing an easily exploitable soft spot, I teased him about his homophobia. Our argument got louder and louder until our boss entered the office and said, "The new rule is the rule. Accept it or resign." My colleague eventually resigned, but I liked my job, so I decided to embrace gays and lesbians. A few years later, I started attending Unitarian services and found myself virtually surrounded by gays and lesbians who seemed so much like me that it confounded all of my BC interior notions of what they should be. It didn't take me long to become an ally, and I'm proud to say that I stand on the side of love. When I march in the Victoria Pride Parade next Sunday, I'll be marching for all of those people who chose not to march, either because they were closeted or because, like me, for many years they were afraid. Today I wanted to tell you about how a riot outside a gay bar and an international medical crisis led Canadians of all affections to openly celebrate their GLBT neighbors in pride parades. I wanted to connect these stories with your story. And now at the end, I want to exhort you to join in the pride parade next Sunday, either marching or cheering from the sidelines. Thank you.